2016 mouse report now before we go to our bumper music for the day. Let me zoom in on a few little headlines here. Top U.S. spy agency refuses to endorse CIA's Russian hacking assessment due to lack of evidence. There's Zero Hedge. Greg Plast delivers a petition to the DOJ to demand an investigation. Breaking: Greg Plast hand delivers 50,000 signature petition to the Department of Justice, Washington, D.C., in washed up deceit, to demand an investigation into interstate cross-check, a racially based tool of mass vote suppression, which was used in 2 out of 3 states to manipulate the results of the 2016 election. So now we are going to be backing this double semi. Now remember, this was the stealing of the stolen election. So we got to back it up, right? So we don't want to hand it to the original Seth. Anyway, or do we? Some anguish over another Republican coup, maybe on principle, but I didn't puke out my door like with the first Jim Crow coup in 2000, even though we dodged the Clinton bullets by diving into the Trump cesspool. The Clintons are the first string in contra death squads, losing, thank God, us in Aleppo. So what's that doing on our list of miseries if you listen up and down the dial? Crocodile tears for death squads. How can Trump do worse than the 10 million corpses plus the Clintons are piling up in Central Africa under Museveni and Kagame since 1990 Rwanda invasion launched by Hitler's banker, son of Hitler's banker, rather, their boss, Poppy Bush? Oh, dear. About those crocodile tears, we do have a debate, and let me click on that. Here's from Scott Benner on Russia and the Syrian wars end. On
another debate, I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out.
So we must remain cautious.
It appears that the Syrian government's gains in eastern Aleppo against the terrorists have caused such a major policy shift.
We could consider that this is a major defeat for the friends of Syria. We don't know what their next step could be because there's so much instability on their side, while there's such a united plan on the part of Syria, Russia, and Iran.
Assad and his supporters have repeatedly stressed that diplomacy is the only solution, but the insistence on undemocratic regime change has forced the conflict to go on for more than 5 deadly and destructive years. Perhaps true diplomacy is finally on the horizon.
Placement of a quarter of his own citizens and the killings of, or contribution to the killing of about 400,000 to 500,000 Syrians. There is no democracy in Syria.
All
and
right.
Until Assad is somehow removed,
okay,
and
so
democratic elections occur.
Well, right, Mr. Millett, just stay with me. Mr. Bennett, let me get you in on this. I guess you found some of the comments comical. We're still hearing Assad must go. Your take, sir.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a tragic comedy, and I must admit it is giving me a little bit of laughter and comical relief to hear such ludicrous comments and propaganda. And I worked in propaganda. That's why I find it laughable. Listen, let's make it really simple. What the friends of Syria want to do to Bashar Assad is exactly what they did to Muammar Gaddafi. Castrate him and kill him with a bayonet and turn the country into a Wahhabi, Takfiri, Salafist chaos and fire that is now spreading up into Europe. They want to do the same thing in Syria so that they can continue on into Iran. There is no other agenda other than this Wahhabi, Takfiri, Salafist, Qatar, Saudi Arabian agenda to finance these mercenaries to push up into Syria and turn it into a hellhole. That's why Russia stepped in. That's why Iran stepped in. That's why China stepped in. This isn't anything about Bashar Assad, who incidentally I think is a very intelligent, very decent, very businesslike man, who many United States politicians have supported and like and have written statements about it, including Senator Dick Black, including Tulsi Gabbard, including Donald Trump, including many others that are coming to the realization that Syria and Bashar Assad must remain in order to destroy this chaos forest fire that's been out of control that the United States, okay, CIA and the Pentagon have been throwing gasoline on to erupt into future conflict.
All so right, stay with
it's
him, Mr.
ending.
Bennett.
That's why they're so desperate.
Stay with Mr. Bennett. What about what our guest has said, Mr. Miller, guest in San Francisco, that actually many politicians are coming to the realization that, as a matter of fact, it is needed for the stability of the region, for the destroying the terrorists, if that is really the goal, as a matter of fact, to have the Syrian government stay intact, or unless and until the people themselves vote to change it, it actually adds stability to the area and to the country itself. What's your take on that? Because obviously there are a lot of terrorists that are being killed these days there.
Well, I fear that my colleague, Mr. Bennett, would probably have found Hitler. Countries having their own regional interests in which they want to control and maintain Syria under their own power structure. You have a Shia-controlled Syria. Saudi Arabia have to get round the table and bash out their own differences between the two countries, the two ideologies, because until Iran and Saudi Arabia bash out their own differences, there is never going to be peace in the region, whatever takes place.
Okay, Mr.
Now we see the truth.
Go ahead, Mr. Bennett. Mr. Bennett, you wanted to comment?
Well, Mr. Millett just enunciated the entire Zionist plan to destabilize the Middle East with a inter-Muslim conflict. Aha! Now we see what the true agenda is. Let's get the Saudi Arabians fighting the Iranians. Let's cause all sorts of chaos and rumbling and sectarian fighting.
Well, the perfect song for foul murder day.
Distant signs, you pour yourself over me like the sun through the blinds. You lift me up and get me out, keep me walking but never shout. Hold the secret close, I hear you say. You know the way, it twists and turns, changing colors, spinning yarns. You know the way, it leaves you dry, it cuts you up and takes you high. You know the way, it's painted gold, is it honey, is it cold? You know the way, it goes about, it takes you in and spits you out.
shattered, wearing burlap, living in crumbling mud huts. And we, the United States and the Israel Zionist lobby, will be able to expand the Greater Israel Project. We'll be able to expand our other influences into the region. We'll be able to do all sorts of empire building. That's been the plan since September 11, 2001, when they were notoriously implicated in the September 11th attacks. So this plan of causing the Saudi Arabians and Iran and Syria to, quote, hash it out and have a conflict, that's nonsense. That's what the Russians stepped in to stop. No, we're stopping this hashing it out because it's destabilizing all of humanity. And for the sake of all of humanity, we're going to come in and create stability and order and peace and protect this region from another Libyan fall, from another Iraqi fall, from another attempted Egyptian fall. It's not going to go any further. And Europe is waking up to that. That's
and actually seeming to be very, very happy that they have actually reached safety. And overall, 50,000 people have been liberated in 2 days, as, of course, the Russians and the Syrians have allowed the free passage. Now, we heard what our guest, Mr. Millett, said in London, the consistent bombing from the air, the destruction of the people and infrastructure. It doesn't really seem that way if we're talking about 50,000 people in 2 days and actually seeming to be very, very happy that they have actually reached safety. Your take, sir, and your perspective, what is really going on?
Well, you wisely identified the most important voice in the room, and that is the Syrian people. The most important people and their opinions that really matter, not Mr. Millett's, not mine, are the people who've lived in Aleppo. And what they're saying when they come out and overrun the Russian reintegration centers, God bless them, thank you for having them, is that we're very thankful to the Russians for protecting us, for destroying the terrorists. We've been under capture and siege by the terrorists who are pretending to be Democrats, who are pretending to be trying for civil rights and all that nonsense. No, they've been about a Wahhabi agenda to create a tyrannical regime of chaos and bloodshed there. That's what Russia and Syria were fighting against. And the Syrian people are coming out confirming that. They're confirming the bestiality of these foreign-backed terrorists who've went into Syria. And there is nothing wrong with destroying these terrorists, these beheaders of women, these rapists of boys, because they are beyond any human decency. And for the fact that the Western nations have backed them in order to remove Assad for regime change is suicidal, because it's now out of control and flooding into Europe. So Russia has stepped in and done the humanitarian action. The only thing they need to do more of is inject some passion when they appear on the United Nations. Mr. Millett mentioned passion. Vitaly Churkin needs to stand up and say, we don't trust the West anymore because you've bombed our convoys, you've financed terrorism, you've done everything that the world community objects to, and we are a voice of protecting people's lives and human rights, and we're not going to give you an inch to breathe, we're not going to give you an inch of ground, we're going to create a highway for you to get out of town, but we're not going to talk to you, we're not going to give you anything, because your entire agenda is bloodshed, chaos, and regime change.
Okay.
Those are just the facts. Now, people are trying to spin their way out of it and say it's about humanitarian lives in crisis, but that's all propaganda. And these journalists and these white hats, all CIA, Mossad, MI6 agents. That is all propaganda. So you can't believe
okay.
a word that...
What is it going to take to actually wrap this all up?
Well, I think you're going to see an exodus of the militants and the terrorists and the Wahhabi Takfiris back into their own lands, back into Saudi Arabia, back into Qatar, back into Kuwait, and hopefully they'll foment the same revolution and overchange that they were trying to do in Syria. That's precisely what needs to happen to end the wars, is the Saudi Arabian regimes and the Qatari regimes and the Kuwaiti regimes, which are all incestuous royal family oppressions and tyrannies, they're not democracies, they're the ones who need to be overthrown, and it's going going to be comically ironic when all of these savages come out of Syria and are bussed back into their homes of in Riyadh and elsewhere, and suddenly they will probably be engaging in the same overthrow revolutionary activities only on their own lands. Now, I saw personally when I was in the army, one of the greatest things that these regimes like to do is pay off these criminals and push them out of their country to cause trouble elsewhere. Well, those days are done. Now we're putting them back in their home countries. They're not going to be allowed in Europe. They're certainly not going to be allowed in Russia, Iran, or China. So where are they going to go? They're going to go back to their home turf of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, and they are going to engage in the regime overthrow of their tyrant dictators. Bashar Assad was voted to his by his people. Those people in Saudi Arabia were not. They are the subjugators, and they're the ones who need to be removed.
All right, on that note, I thank both of you for being with us. Former U.S. Army Psychological Warfare Officer, Mr. Scott Bennett, out of San Francisco, and journalist and political commentator, Mr. Richard Millett, out of London. And as always, viewers, we appreciate you being with us. Join me right here, same time, same place tomorrow on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out.
A master plan by the Canadian government and Catholic and Protestant churches to exterminate Indigenous nations has been in operation across Canada since November 25, 1910. This plan was authorized and has been maintained by the Crown of England and its Privy Council Office, the Vatican, Catholic, Anglican, and United Church of Canada, along with Royal Canadian Mounted Police, local police, the judiciary, and private corporations. This plan consisted of a state and church-funded program of systemic intergenerational genocide based initially within the so-called Indian residential school system, established by a federal law in July 1, 1920. Over a century, that system killed more than half of the children incarcerated within it, or more than 65,000 children. It has also served as the launching pad for a general campaign of ethnic cleansing, aimed primarily at the non-assimilated, predominantly Western Aboriginal tribes, a campaign that continues to the present day. This genocide has accounted for the massive depopulation of more than 95% of the original West Coast Native Nations, a total killing of somewhere around 1 million people. Besides such a general depopulation, the specific purpose of this genocidal campaign was the extermination of the traditional Indigenous kinship network and the matriarchal clan mother system of authority that ensured Indigenous control of lands and resources.
That's from a Foul Murder Day episode of Mouse Report. Let me think. Macmillan Bloedel is Weyerhaeuser. And those kind of things lately are Chinese corporations, no doubt. So... 11/22/16 on, I don't know, the Indie Bay is hard to find my, but go to Greg Allen Getty on Facebook, and I link my uploads every time. Oh yeah, here's Eva Bartlett on the ongoing media blitz, dropping barrel bombs of BS on Damascus. In your ears.
Touch on something that Sarah Flounders mentioned, which is that today in the General Assembly, the representative of my country, Canada, is raising or has raised a resolution which is not about human rights. It's not about the people of Syria. It's a resolution meant to point fingers and to vilify the governments of Syria and Russia. And this resolution relates to a UN Security Council resolution that was vetoed by Russia and China some days ago. That resolution pertained to another useless ceasefire in Syria, which would have no bearing on, bring no good to the people of Syria, and which follows a week of liberation of areas of Aleppo, which now amounts to about 95% of areas of Aleppo that have been occupied for years by terrorist factions.
And this is December 9th, So, I think 4 days old.
So at this time, when 100,000 civilians in these areas occupied for years by terrorist factions have been liberated, the UN, parties in the UN wanted to impose another ceasefire. And I want to remind people why these ceasefires are indeed pointless. The last ceasefire in September was from the very start negated by 20 main terrorist factions who declared they were not going to participate, and from the very beginning violated the ceasefire over 300 times during the duration of the ceasefire. And not only these terrorist factions, while the Syrians and while the Russians adhered to the tenets of the ceasefire, but the American-led coalition itself violated the ceasefire by targeting Syrian army positions in Deir ez-Zor, killing at least 83 Syrian soldiers in a prolonged attack that lasted nearly 1 hour and which enabled ISIS to overtake that position. So this is one reason why a ceasefire is pointless at this point in time. There is no faith that any of the parties, that the U.S. and Western leaders who have funded these terrorists, there's no faith that they can actually control the terrorists and get them to adhere to a ceasefire. And the people of Aleppo want Aleppo to be completely freed. And I speak having been to Aleppo 4 times, and this is the will of people in Aleppo. So on that note, I'd just like to talk about, briefly, I've been to Syria 6 times since 2014, 2 of which were with international delegations, and 4 times were independently on a visa I applied for, paid for, and waited for. My trips have been self-funded or fundraised, and I've gone at my own risk and been able to travel freely in the country to areas I wish to travel to. I've been many times to Homs, to Maloula, to Latakia, Tartus, Siaf, Sweida, and again Aleppo 4 times. And I mention these because I think it's important people realize I have, in, wherever I've gone, I've spoken in Arabic to the people I'm speaking with. What Donna, what Sarah have said, that the people support their army and government is absolutely true. Whatever you hear in the corporate media is the complete opposite. And on that note, what you hear in the corporate media, and I will name them, BBC, Guardian, New York Times, etc., on Aleppo is also opposite of reality. Aleppo since 2012 has been inhabited by different terrorist factions, among them al-Nusra, among them the so-called Free Syrian Army, which has committed the same heinous acts of terrorism as al-Nusra, as ISIS, as Ahrar al-Sham, as Nur al-Din al-Zinki, which beheaded a 12-year-old Palestinian child, and somehow is still deemed moderate. Since 2012, these areas of Aleppo, which have now recently been freed, their occupation by these terrorist factions has meant the greater Aleppo, the 1.5 million plus population of greater Aleppo, have suffered sieges denying them food and medicine. They've suffered for years a want of electricity and water, and they've suffered daily bombardment by these terrorists of mortars, of gas canister bombs, which are improvised and made locally, of water heater bombs, which are even more powerful and can level floors of entire buildings, of conventional weapons like Grad rockets supplied by the West, and et cetera. As I said, they've suffered these attacks on a daily basis, and even now, because there are still Western-backed terrorists in pockets of Aleppo, there are still mortars and gas canister bombs raining down, and people are still dying in Aleppo. This is another reason why the liberation and securing of these areas is imperative, because that will actually bring peace to Aleppo. Now, my colleagues here mentioned the nature of unity in Syria and the fact that Syrians are see themselves first as Syrian before any sect. This is an important point because our media and the Gulf media has made Syria out to be sectarian, which is something the Syrians themselves have denied. But it's a tool to make people confused. It's a tool to make people believe that it's Sunnis against Bashar al-Assad, when in fact, bear in mind that Aleppo is overwhelmingly Sunni and is with the government and is with the army and is suffering from the terrorists who declare that they are liberating the city in Syria. Other points about Aleppo are hospitals in Aleppo have been attacked. I'm sure you've heard in the media that hospitals have been attacked. Well, this media is referring to the pockets of Aleppo that were occupied by terrorists. And they have manufactured stories, and I can give you a precise account. In April of this year, there was a hospital called the Al-Quds Hospital, which in a concerted effort, all media said was attacked and targeted and badly damaged by either the Syrians or the Russians. In fact, the Russians had satellite imagery showing that this hospital was in the same shape that it was in October 2015. No difference. Therefore, it was not attacked. Months later, The Guardian, which is a prominent British newspaper, actually said the Al-Quds hospital that it had alleged months prior to be attacked and destroyed was treating victims of so-called chemical weapons attacks. So even the media that is lying is inconsistent in their lies. But there have been hospitals attacked. I went to the Al-Dabit Hospital, which is in Aleppo City. It's a maternity hospital. It was attacked on May 3rd, and three women were killed. You would think this would be something raised at the UN or by so-called human rights groups, but it was not. In December 2013, the Kindi Hospital was attacked and destroyed. It was the largest and best cancer treatment hospital in the Middle East. It was destroyed by al-Nusra terrorist truck bombings. And in fact, in recent media reports on Aleppo, again alleging Syrian or Russian strikes on hospitals, Fox News actually had the audacity to use a photo of Al-Kindi Hospital and allege that this is in eastern areas of Aleppo and that this hospital had been attacked by Syrian or Russian strikes. This goes to show how much the media has been lying from the very beginning about Syria and continues to lie. When I went to Aleppo, I spoke with the Aleppo Medical Association. They comprise 4,160 active and registered doctors. More lies in the media have said the last doctor in Aleppo, the last pediatrician in Aleppo. Of these over 4,000 doctors, 800 of them are specialists. So you can see that when the media talks about Aleppo, it's talking about areas that were occupied by terrorists. And it's completely negating the suffering and the will of the Syrian people in Greater Aleppo. When I was in Aleppo in July, I got a taste of some of the bombings by these terrorist factions. There was an explosion about half a kilometer away at Hattat Baghdad, and I don't know how many people were killed that day, but it was close enough that it was a massive plume of smoke. About 5 minutes later, an explosive bullet fired from an area occupied by terrorists landed about 15 meters away from where I was. If it had hit parked cars, I wouldn't be here speaking. A day later, a good friend of mine, his mother, was killed by one such explosive bullet. So this is just a small taste of what people are suffering on a daily basis. In November, when I was there with a delegation of Western journalists, including from the New York Times, LA Times, BBC, etc., on November 3rd, there were a series of attacks throughout the day with Grad missiles, explosive vehicles, and other explosive bullets and snipings. By the end of the day, 18 people, civilians, were murdered and over 200 were injured, including critically. We were at the Al-Razi Hospital, which is one of the main hospitals, and we saw the maimed people pour in. And this was just one day of many of endless days in Aleppo. On November 4th, we were at the Castello Road humanitarian crossing. This was a day that was meant to allow the people in eastern areas of Aleppo that were inhabited by terrorists to evacuate. And this was not the first time. On prior occasions, the Syrians and the Russians had opened 8 humanitarian corridors to enable people to leave. These were attacked by terrorist factions heavily. Even that day on November 4th, the Castello Road crossing was attacked twice with mortar shelling when we were there and 5 times afterwards. Clearly, there has been political will and intent by the Syrian government and its Russian allies to enable civilians to leave, to minimize any sort of loss of human life. Clearly, the terrorists that declare themselves liberators of Syria do not want people to leave. They've been holding civilians hostage. And if you're following reports that are not BBC and that are not New York Times, you will see countless testimonies of civilians, of the 100,000 civilians who've been liberated the last week, saying, thank God for the Syrian Arab army that liberated us. And the terrorists were hoarding food. They were preventing us from having food. This is all documented. Also documented are that areas in these areas occupied by terrorists, including a school, were housing chemicals used to make chemical weapons. And you could see also the gas canisters that were used to make explosive gas canister bombs. In fact, even when I was in Leir Amun, we saw a factory in one of the buildings that was used to make gas canister bombs. In Leir Amun, we also saw evidence of the so-called Free Syrian Army that some people say doesn't exist anymore. The 16th Brigades was active there. They had a cell underground, 3 stories below, that was perfectly intact in spite of aerial bombings above ground. And I make this point because people talk about the destruction in Aleppo as if the physical destruction matters. It's the people that the Syrian government and the Syrian people care about. And the destruction in areas occupied by terrorists occurs because the terrorists are bunkering below ground, come up above ground, fire their bombs on civilian populations, and go back below ground. So I just want to address a few other myths. Some of the myths that have been about Aleppo and Syria in general have been that the Syrian government and army are starving the population. Again, I refer to testimonies of people, even people I met with in November. I met with a family of displaced people from Al-Halaq, which is north of Bustan al-Pasha, which was an area, both areas occupied by terrorists. At that time, when I met them on November 10th, he told me that they had fled along with about 40 others on about 20 days prior, and that they had tried twice prior to flee, but they were prevented violently so from doing so by the terrorists that inhabited those areas. This is the case. These are the testimonies coming out of Aleppo now. People saying, we tried to flee, they wouldn't let us, they shot at us. There are also videos showing people who did manage to flee coming under fire in the Syrian army, actually protecting them, acting as human shields. So that's to say that what we've been hearing in the corporate media is not depicting an accurate image of what's happening in Aleppo. The corporate media is saying that the Syrian army is attacking people, and until today, the corporate media is maintaining this, even though the exact opposite is true. I would ask you to follow the voices of people in Syria who, like my colleagues here said, they want you to speak the truth. They're tired of lies. They're very well aware of the lies that our media is purporting and that our human rights groups are purporting. They want an end to the violence. They don't want this war to continue. They didn't ask for this war. But as my colleagues stressed, Syria is a sovereign nation. It has the right to fight against terrorism. And we know that 101 of 193 UN member states have sent terrorists to Syria to slaughter and destroy. So Syria is fighting a war against terrorism. It's winning in Aleppo. And hopefully either the terrorists will accept a deal to be transported out of Aleppo. Hopefully they will participate in the Musalaha, the reconciliation, will lay down their arms, will take the amnesty offered to them by the government and which has been taken by thousands of former militants. And hopefully, above all, the U.S. will stop supporting terrorism and stop funding terrorism. And hopefully this new bill will take fire, will be supported, and actually it will be impossible to fund and armed mercenaries from FSA, Ahrar al-Sham, Nur al-Din al-Zinki, and all the colors in between, because they're all the same terrorists.
Al-Zinki, of course, Mark Toner, was acknowledging, you gringo, give them weapons. They beheaded 11-year-old Abdullah, and the guy who filmed himself with them was the guy who took Omran, the dust-covered child's photo. You know, the blue-white helmet scam that all the mockingbird left parrot.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Eva. Very informative. Thank you very much.
So that was Eva Bartlett, December 9th.
Now we are open to questions, if there are questions. The gentleman in the back.
Thank you very much. I'm Christopher Ronneberg with the Norwegian newspaper Aftenposten. A question for, or two questions for Ms. Bartlett here. As a journalist, I'm sure you can appreciate getting other impressions than empirical impressions from the ground. When you talk about the Syrian people and what the Syrian people want, how can you quantify that? Do you have any independent surveys where you can actually document that? And secondly, you talk about the corporate media, the Western media, the lies and all of this. Could you explain what you think might be the agenda from us in the Western media, and why we should lie, why the international organizations on the ground should lie, why we shouldn't believe all these absolutely documentable facts that we see from the ground, these hospitals being bombed, these civilians who are talking about the atrocities that they have been experiencing? How can you justify calling all of us liars?
Sure.
Thank you.
I mean, there are certainly honest journalists amongst the very compromised establishment media. Let's start with your second question. So, international organizations on the ground. Tell me which ones are on the ground in Eastern Aleppo. Yeah, okay, I'll tell you. There are none. There are none. These organizations are relying on the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is based in Coventry, UK, and which is one man. They're relying on compromised groups like the White Helmets, which let's talk about the White Helmets. The White Helmets were founded in 2013 by a British ex-military officer. They have been funded to the tune of $100 million by the US, UK, and Europe and other states. They purport to be rescuing civilians in eastern Aleppo and Idlib, yet no one in eastern Aleppo has heard of them. And I say no one, bearing in mind that now 95% of these areas of eastern Aleppo are liberated. The White Helmets purport to be neutral, yet they can be found carrying guns and standing in the dead bodies of Syrian soldiers. And their video footage actually contains children that have been recycled in different reports. So you can find a girl named Aya who turns up in a report in month, say, August, and she turns up in the next month in two different locations. So they are not credible. The SOHR is not credible. Unnamed activists are not credible. Once or twice, maybe, but every time, not credible. So your sources on the ground, you don't have them. As for your agenda, not your, but the agenda of some corporate media, it is the agenda of regime change. How can the New York Times, I was reading it this morning, or how can Democracy Now!, which I was reading the other day, maintain until this day that this is a civil war in Syria? How can they maintain until this day that there were that the protests were unarmed and nonviolent until, say, 2012? That is absolutely not true.
And we just heard Scott Bennett describe being in the military planning with Barack and Hillary, the death squad invasion that is finally getting kicked out of Aleppo. Now, there's this, I was going to bug out this. Oh, yeah, so you mentioned the Soros-funded project, of course, that's business partners with Carlyle and all company, the assassins-in-chief. Carlucci and the Hitler's Bank gang, Prescott's son, Poppy Bush, head of the opium war, Afghan opium war, and
position of ThreatCon Delta, as far as I know, was when the USS Cole was attacked in the Gulf region.
So Robert Knight and John Judge and Michael Rupert and Peter Matheson, never mind, all gone in a month critiquing the CIA, But
at this point in time, now in the United States, there is a ThreatCon Delta at the Department of Defense.
And we go now to the gentleman who's just walked in. Can you tell us your name and where you were when the explosion took place?
Now, mind you, she has just described explosion after explosion and the paper coming down, the office paper like confetti, so that she singularizes to begin with.
My name is Ezel Harris. I was just off the bridge by Church Street when the second tower went down.
And what did you see?
It came down like a house of cards. There was, appeared to me to be a series of explosions, both on the top level of the building and on the ground.
And he repeats that. When Dennis asked him, no, as a construction worker, did it surprise you how easily the towers came down? And he said, let me tell you, it didn't come down easy. When we put a building with them, I tell you, there was a series of explosions. So he's repeating, there was a series of explosions. Not only did the aircraft come from the top, but at the base of the building as well. We knew after the second aircraft, there wasn't an accident because it was restricted airspace. So you're listening to Ezel Harris. I have captured my audience, taking them into the Wayback Machine to 9/11/01, and 10 points down the dial, where Amy was turning deaf ears and blind eyes to the series of explosions described on that day, playing dumb about the only possible suspect, the Pentagon and its drone pilots and covert demolition teams for the air defense stand-down operation before a remote-controlled jet crashes three tower demolitions, ignoring our hand on the cloaked dagger of our cannon fodder for the Holy Land Project to divide Ukraine, Iraq, Syria, Libya into a series of weak and containable apartheid auxiliaries across the region of our oil wars. Blowback that happens to be following the divide-and-conquer rule, which should be recognized as an operational success rather than a failure in accomplishing fictional aims. And so The actual success is having an actual failure now in Aleppo. But let me jump to Eve, because the whole point was Western media lies, and she's going to detail this some more.
How can they maintain that the Syrian government is attacking civilians in Aleppo when every person that's coming out of these areas occupied by terrorists is saying the opposite? So that's with regards to your question on lying Western media. How do I quantify the support of the Syrian people? The elections. In 2014, the Syrian people held elections. The voter turnout was 88%, including people in Lebanon, where I was during the elections in Lebanon, which were actually ran for 2 days, extended hours, people walking for kilometers to reach the embassy, including people who flew from their own countries like mine, which has criminally shut the Syrian embassy so that Syrian people have no rights, and including people within Syria who braved a torrent of terrorist mortars and missiles on election day. And yet, voter turnout rate was something like 88%, I believe. And then the election, the results were 78, I believe. I think
Tim Anderson gives you the opposite.
Okay, I might get the turnout wrong. So the results.
74%, 88%.
Okay. Anyway, the point being, overwhelmingly, the people support President Assad. That's based on elections, based on my own travels. Okay, so that's subjective. But as I said, I've traveled around Syria, talked with people of all faiths, all walks of life, and there are people that want change in the government. We're not pretending they don't want change. Everybody wants change. But in terms of support of the government, the point is they don't see President Assad as the problem. They see the problem as terrorism. They see elements of problems in the system that they have there. But President Assad, they don't see as the problem. They actually overwhelmingly support him. So I'm basing it on their choice in their leader, and I'm basing it on my interactions with people in Syria and Lebanon.
Thank you, Eva Bartlett. Western media lies about Syria exposed. Canadian journalist Eva Bartlett from Tyranny Unmasked on YouTube.
There were cars, there were trucks, emergency response vehicles, pandemonium, something just like out of, you might as well call this Die Hard 4.
What did you think was happening? Were you listening to a radio?
No, I work in a federal building in Brooklyn across the bridge, and we're building a federal post office there. I'm a steam fitter by trade, Local 638. Our building was evacuated, and upon our building being evacuated, myself and some other construction workers, we rushed to the area to volunteer our services for anything that we, you know, could be useful to or for.
So you'd come across the bridge and you knew something bad had happened to one of the towers.
I knew something bad happened before I even got to the bridge, because we, once again, I say I work in a federal building. The building was evacuated. The job was shut down and the building was evacuated immediately. That was when the first tower got struck. So, and we could see clearly the smoke and debris, but the second tower was still standing at that time.
And so what happened with the people on the street where you were, Church Street, just blocks away?
It was pandemonium. People running everywhere, running for cover, ducking. A lot of people in shock. It was just chaos, complete, unadulterated chaos.
And what did you do?
What I tried to do is after the smoke cleared a bit, because, you know, debris came down, ash and smoke and everything else, the first thing I did was I found an emergency response team and asked what could I do. Just off right on it, the police department were right
of it.
The finest construction armies in the world. Our people are craftsmen, we're tradesmen, we know what we're doing. We put a building up, it's up. So for somebody to take it down, that's one of the reasons why I came across. This is my city and I build it. Anything that happens to right on it, the police department were right on it, and a group of our construction workers, we got together and cleared a path for the emergency vehicles to get in, because like I said, there was debris all over the place. There was potential for gas explosions, there was smoke, asbestos, fire retardant, you name it, insulation.
And what kind of injuries did people have?
There were a lot of, I saw a lot of gashes, a lot of flesh injuries, a lot of burns, a lot of smoke inhalation. I saw people covered in gray, so like if they had been at the base of a volcanic eruption, just a fine layer of gray everywhere. It coats the city now as the emergency response vehicles, as they go through the streets, it blows up. It's all over the place. It's just like somebody just blew New York up.
This is Dennis Bernstein here. Let me ask the gentleman, as a construction worker, were you shocked to see how easily the buildings seemed to go down? Or was this a surprise to you?
As a construction worker, sir, I'd like to tell you that it wasn't easy for the building to come down. They didn't come down easily. That's number one. I believe that there was a series of explosions. I believe that not only did the aircraft come from the top, I believe there were some base explosions at the bottom. When we put something up, it's up. New York is one of the finest construction armies in the world. Our people are craftsmen, we're tradesmen, we know what we're doing. We put a building up, it's up. So for somebody to take it down, that's one of the reasons why I came across. This is my city and I build it. Anything that happens to one of my buildings in this city, I want to know about it. I want to go find out what's going on. I want to volunteer my services to help any way I can.
You said you work in the federal building in Brooklyn. Who do you work for?
I work for a local 638. I'm a steam fitter. We are currently doing a project in Brooklyn. It's a post office. It is several federal buildings in Brooklyn. We are doing a renovation job there. But it's a federal building. Being as such, as soon as we were aware that there were, as soon as the word went out that it was a possible terrorist attack, that this wasn't, and we knew after the second aircraft, we knew that it wasn't an accident because we know, it's restricted airspace. But the federal government mobilized immediately to evacuate all of their buildings. And that's just government protocol.
Well, Amy, we want to thank this gentleman. Is there another question before we move on? We have Phyllis Bennis with us in one.
Of the consideration that the planes were really diversionary. The planes created this incredible...
But the point was restricted airspace, so it's obvious the rubber nose in it. It's controlled airspace, whoever's controlling the airspace, lets it happen, but really makes it happen. It's not a let it happen on purpose, it's a made it happen on purpose. Where was I?
When shelters the silent, corale, que te va a matar. Hijo de la rebeldía, lo siguen 20 más 20, porque regala tu vida. Ellas les quieren dar muerte.
Line of movement. Every one of you knows that public education is under attack. You know some of the details in this city or that, such as that Katrina was used as the excuse to fire 7,000 teachers and thousands of support staff. What matters here is how we can win. So, one answer is this, the beginning with this sit-in. We want to keep the school this weekend. We plan to do the Freedom School starting Monday. Another thing you can do, and we hope to have large enough crowds, and I mean we would like to have thousands of people, so that suddenly it becomes the same kind of issue in this city that the port shutdown was in this city, which was a model of struggle. We want people to come out and support this sit-in to demand that schools remain open.
Everybody sing. check. My check. I have an announcement. If anybody has something to say in order to keep things organized, please make an announcement on this microphone.
Everybody, we're re-meeting at Oscar Grant Plaza tonight at 10 p.m. Meet us back at Oscar Grant Plaza at 10 p.m.
Welcome back to The Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. This week, we continue coverage of the never-ending 2016 presidential election and the recounts and voter fraud.
Give us 20 minutes and we'll give you the word.
Jackson means that, ironically, probably information wars. I want to get into Bev Harris because she's going to talk about the fractional. So they got these fractions, but of course the vote is a whole number. So what do you got programs with fractions? Obviously, you're bending over to get screwed when you bend in over in that voting booth because, never mind. Bev Harris on lack of intent. Election integrity.
With someone who it's my honor to present, Bev Harris. You all probably know who Bev is, but she's an American writer, activist, and founder of Black Box Voting, a national nonpartisan elections watchdog group. She helped to popularize the term Black Box Voting while authoring a book of that title. So stay tuned and we'll be right back with Bev Harris. Bev Harris of Black Box Voting. That's kind of hard to say. You can't say it too fast. It's an honor to finally have you on Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Well, it's absolutely an honor to meet you, Cindy.
Yeah, it's great to finally talk to you in person. I've been following your work for years.
Well, that's actually a compliment. I didn't know that, but I've been following you. So, mutual admiration society for sure. You expect that elections are supposed to be accountable to the public because, after all, we own them.
Right.
And it was very surprising to see kind of the amount of defensiveness among the, I guess you'd call it the elections industry, which is both private and public officials and companies, and an incredible amount of secrecy. It was just bizarre because before I had done writing about elections, I had done writing in the 90s about financial fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And these people reminded me of embezzlers, to tell you the truth. It was the same kind of attitudes you got, the same kind of dodging and weaving when you tried to track any kind of accountability for the numbers they were providing. And so I just really got interested in it. And over the course of the next 10 years, HBO made a documentary about my work and have done a lot of different studies. But in the course of that, I've evolved as well.
What's the
in
name
the
of
beginning,
that?
I thought.
What's the name of the HBO documentary?
The name of the documentary on HBO is Hacking Democracy.
Hacking Democracy,
yes. It was nominated for it's a 2006 documentary. It was nominated for an Emmy. And in it, we showed election officials literally covering up and throwing away election records, and we were finding counterfeit copies of them and so forth. But over the course of the last 10 years, when I mention I've evolved, this is what I mean. At first I thought, well, there's some problems in this, and so if we simply bring those problems to the attention of legislators and so forth, they will want to solve those problems.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, was I naive? They want it exactly the way it is. They right. want a system that's manipulatable and that's secret.
Same, we had kind of the same trajectory. After my son was first killed, I just thought if I would go to Congress and pour my heart out that they would see the error of their ways. And in the wars, it goes a lot deeper than that, doesn't it?
It does. And, it was just, and by the way, I'm so sorry about your son. I have a son by the same name, actually.
Just
my heart went out to you.
Aww.
Yeah. It's been quite an awakening it's quite clear, actually, that, not at first I thought, well, theoretically, people could be doing things with elections and they could be tampering with them and it might be happening sporadically here and there. There's absolutely no doubt. I mean, and what's odd is, I've actually caught them in the act, actually videotaped people in the act of tampering with elections. And there's nobody to investigate and nobody to enforce. And when you start going down that rabbit hole, you go to the Secretary of State and they say, well, we have no enforcement power. That would be the Attorney General. And you go to the Attorney General and they say, well, we have no investigative power. That would be the Secretary of State. And if you go to the local prosecutor, he says, well, my job is to represent the election official, so I have a conflict of interest. You can't find anybody to even investigate unless it comes through a very narrow portal of violating specific civil rights for persons who are of disadvantaged populations.
Right.
That's the only way, and then you can bring in federal under equal protection laws. But most of the election tampering, even when witnessed, simply does not get, absolutely nothing is done.
Well, so I did mention our recent fiasco on November 8th, and I listened to some snippets interviews with you, read some of the things that you have written. Apparently, you and I both thought that Clinton was going to win. Now, I thought she was going to win not just because of the compromised voting machines, but also she had every institution behind her, the media, Wall Street, the Pentagon, Israel. She was their candidate. She was the candidate of the Democratic establishment. There was much evidence that the primaries were rigged in her favor. And
when the same thing happens 8 years ago to install Drone Bomber, what happened? But I got my primary ballot 2 months late. I called Secretary of State's office, talked to Mark Loren, head of the criminal fraud unit of Deborah Bowen's office, and so he said, no evidence of crime, like a mantra, like a co-conspirator with drone bombers murders would. But half of the ballots were missing in Contra Costa, about half of the green ballots, that is. So it was impossible for thousands of us to vote for Cynthia McKinney. And similar fashion, you know, the 1% national green vote is really not credible. So, back to Bev Harris on the primary theft and then the theft of the theft. Or it was like she stole it from Bernie and then the deep state handed it to the dictator select.
So
yes.
And so I thought that she was going to win. And I heard you say on one interview that even if she loses, she's going to win. So what do you think happened?
Right. Yeah, that was a shocker because
you are not obsessed by the Contra War. So you've known the Clintons since they sent the National Guard. And this is a Democratic, and the Republican Duke Majan knew better than sending the National Guard to back up death squads, okay, in Central America, where the heads of children are lined up against the back of the church in Mozote, where every single person except Rufina Maya escaped. And you're arming those goons. And when the government is not the death squad structure imposed after the Matanza in 1935, when indigenous people disappeared, then you got death squads to overthrow the government, to double the literacy in a couple of years, gave a UN Health Organization award, okay? Because it cut infant mortality in half. So it's always just like Gaddafi could take Libya from the poorest African state to the richest until you, filthy gringo. Well, anyway, I can't get too bent out of shape that we don't save the bridge over the River Mina to restore the Clinton death squad dictatorship. But it was like a pardon from death sentence when he replaced the son of Hitler's banker, because I would have been ashamed to live through another one of those, but I guess I am ashamed. Never mind.
Yeah, simply because she had, usually with the Republicans running against the Democrats, they both have an elite establishment behind them.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, it wasn't like that, where you had an outsider candidate and then you had an insider, and the insider had reports from some people in both parties.
Right.
So it was really stunning. The loss was really stunning. And I think it will be a while before we really unravel what happened. One of the things that I found is on election night, it's all, oh, everything's fine, you know, here's the result. And then things start to unravel over the next weeks and months, where you start to find all the abnormalities and all the things that didn't actually add up.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it looks to me, and in fact, I guess I don't know why I'd be surprised by this, but it looks to me like there was actually cross tampering going on. And, you know, it's so interesting. Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, is doing recounts in these different states.
Right.
Initially got pushback from both sides, you know, and then finally when it became apparent that she had raised the money and was going ahead, the Clinton campaign said, well, we'll send our lawyers, but we don't think there's anything there.
Okay.
They changed the law in New Hampshire in 2008 after Dennis Kucinich did a recount, and they made it much more difficult. Is just tawdry. And here's what it is. Humboldt County, California, kind of pioneered this, and they said, I'll tell you what, let's just get an off-the-shelf document scanner from Office Depot, and besides putting our ballots through the voting machines, let's just scan them all and let everybody put them all on the web for everybody to see,
yeah.
Right? They're anonymous. What's wrong with that? And they did that. Of course, the first thing they did that the citizens looked at them and found out that the voting machines had miscounted. But we thought, well, this is a nifty idea. We could have all the election officials just make, you know, just scan them. And in fact, the modern voting machines automatically create scans of every ballot. So let's just get those as a public record. Well, now that's when it really gets informative. They, election officials, when you say, we would like to have a copy of all those pictures of ballots that your machine automatically creates, they say things like, we destroy those every day. That, I'm not kidding. That's what they said in Arizona and Colorado. Or, it's against the law for anybody to look at a ballot ever, even in freedom of information. So it's when you start seeing that, that's classic cover-up.
Right.
I mean, you might as well be driving down the freeway in a white Bronco, you know, $10,000 in the glove compartment, saying, oh, no, nothing to see here. Uh-huh. You know, we're hiding all the evidence. So when you see stuff like that, you know they're tampering. I mean, it's a simple explanation. They're doing something. They don't want you to see the evidence. But there actually are simple explanations. And so at this point, the fight has kind of migrated into something kind of optimistic, where a lot of reporters and citizens are, and all kinds of folks are getting behind the idea of release all those pictures right away on election night of the ballots, because they're already there, and then peg them to the real ballots with serial number or something so that we can go and look at the real ballot and make sure it's the same thing if we want, using freedom of information laws. It doesn't cost anybody anything to do that, and we can already do it. And then start making a list of the people who are resisting this and hold them up for public ridicule, frankly. You know, these are people who don't want anybody to see how the elections work. Why? Doesn't cost anything. It's already there. So I think this is a whole new wrinkle in what's going on, because we're at last able to say, look, there are solutions to this. If you want us to be able to know that our elections are fair, this is how you can do it. And so we'll see. Some states have agreed. Wisconsin is letting people look at the ballots and ballot images. So is Florida now. So is Michigan now. So these places in Wisconsin with the recount who are saying, we're going to refuse to hand count, the citizens are like, well, that's fine. We're just going to hang around, and we're going to do it under your freedom of information law, and we're going to look at the ballots anyway. And that's where we start to get real traction, I think, toward solutions.
Do you think that the Russians hacked these elections, these voting machines, to make Trump win?
No. No, I don't think they did. No, I think, you know, and I know, because one of the things I did when I first realized how much resistance there was, and people were calling me a conspiracy theorist and all this stuff, and I knew I was right. And so I went to Kentucky and started looking at local elections. Why? Because everybody was perfectly willing to believe that in Kentucky they might rig elections. I don't know why, but, you know, they wanted to think of them as, you know, some sort of hillbillies or something. It's no different in Kentucky than anywhere else. But indeed, you know, I uncovered some elections, and some people actually got indicted for rigging the elections, Clay County, Kentucky, and so forth. So then expanding that out. But so I basically found that the election tampering mechanisms that are kind of built into a lot of the voting system software were kind of put in there because a lot of the locals want to be able to control their own elections for reasons of money, basically. Mm-hmm. You've got a stadium being built, or you've got some huge bond issue going through, or there's a corrupt local sheriff. And so what has, you know, the vendors, and I've even had some of the vendors tell me this, they have a tough time selling election equipment unless it is tamperable.
Unless there's a back door.
Yes, because they won't buy it. They'll buy the other guys who have the back door. So when you look at it that way, it's like, well, wait a minute. The infrastructure is already there to tamper with the presidential. You don't need the Russians. And if you're, it just always sounded to me like propaganda. You know, the Russians are going to come in. What was that all about? It was just all of a sudden, you know.
The Russians hacked into Hillary Clinton's campaign's email because we don't want to look at what those emails actually said, because, you know, that reveals such corrupt, dirty dealings, you know, with the Clinton campaign. And I just, you know, my listeners know I'm not a Trump supporter either, but, you know, we have to highlight these discrepancies and these hypocrisies if we want any change.
Exactly. You know, we really have to, I think we've made a lot, we've gotten a lot of progress in this last election. And I was not a Trump supporter, but I think he did some things that were valuable in calling attention to, you know, when he would say the election is rigged, he may not have known what he was talking about.
Right.
But nobody would even talk about it before that. And nobody right. would even explore the questions involved. They still, you know, the mainstream media, that's when, actually it was after that that the mainstream media started saying it's the Russians, it's the Russians, it's the Russians, which to me was just saying, don't look at the insiders, don't look at the insiders.
Well, it's also like Trump like defeated the Clinton-Bush reign of terror, I should say. And so,
yeah.
I mean, it was valuable that he was highlighting these things, I think. But I had another point that I was going to make, but I forgot. Anyway, one thing before we're over that I'd like you to talk about that I find very fascinating is what you call fraction magic.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, for a long time, we were trying to figure out the easiest way and how it could really be done. And a fellow in Memphis, Tennessee, really cracked the code for that. And it was so simple. And basically, he knew, because he had a combination of different skills. He had a combination of accounting expertise. And book counting is accounting. It's that same type of technology.
Right.
And he had political acumen. So he understood the demographics and what you have to do in order to make it politically plausible. And he had database acumen. And he said, you know, what you have to do, absolutely have to, is it has to be done on the precinct level, because results are reported on the precinct level. He, in Memphis, it's one of those cities where the inner city is all black Democrat and the outer city is mostly white Republican. You cannot just flip votes. It's going to look ridiculous to say, oh, well, we just flipped them all and, oh, suddenly all the black Democrats voted for white Republicans. You know, it just wouldn't be plausible. What you have to do is parse it out by precinct and make it look somewhat plausible. And he knew that. It's absolutely necessary not to do that. And you also can never know how many people are going to show up to vote. So if you just stack the deck and say, I'm going to preload votes into the voting machine, that's not going to work, because what if not that many people show up? You're going to look stupid. So what you have to do is be able to say, by percent, I'm going to give in this precinct, this candidate is going to get this percent, and in this precinct, he's going to get that percent. But he knew that if you do that, it's going to create votes. The votes themselves are going to turn into fractions. And it's like if you have 100 votes, 100 voters show up, and you say, I want this guy to get 25%, that's fine, that's 25 votes. But if 99 voters show up, you've got a vote that's going to have a fraction on the end of it, a decimal on the end of it, because it's not going to divide evenly into 100. And so he knew that the system, the software, would have to be designed to handle votes that had turned into fractions if they were using that kind of, he called it an allocation process. That's what the accounting term is. And he was astounded when he looked at the software, and the first thing he saw was instructions to treat all votes as decimals. And so, in other words, none of the votes are treated as whole numbers. They're all decimalized. There's no legitimate reason to do that in general elections. And so he then did a proof of concept to see, okay, let me see if I can completely change all the votes exactly as I want and have total control over it in every precinct, in every voting style. And literally, he took a place with over 200 precincts and three different voting styles and manipulated every single one of them in 19 seconds. And it was so precise. You can literally spell words with your percentages. Like if A is number one because it's the first letter in the alphabet, and H is number 8 because it's the 8. You could put like ha ha ha, H A H A H A, you know, just by going 8-1-8-1-8-1. I want 81.81% of the votes. It would be that precise, where exactly that percentage of votes would show up for the guy. And then the software also automatically rounds it off. It creates decimals in the votes, and then it rounds it off, so you can't tell the decimals are there.
Is this actually happening?
So. It certainly seems to be, because one of the symptoms that happens if you don't use it skillfully is, you know, if you have 1.25 votes and you have, that's going to round off to one, because it's going to round down. But if you have four of those, it's going to round up, and you're going to get these little, they're called one-off errors, where you, round-off errors, where they kind of accumulate, the debris accumulates.
Uh-huh.
And we have found elections which have they have one-off errors. In fact, one or two off, you know, where you'll have, for example, for simple numbers, if you have 10 voters and there should be 10 votes,
mm-hmm.
There should not be 11 votes and 10 voters. When you start seeing that it's off by one in a number of different races, that's an actual symptom of the fraction magic being used. And another symptom is when the voting machine spit out this little cash register-like tape that has the results on it.
Right.
And if you can get a hold of that and compare it, it's not going to match, because this fraction magic is done centrally at the master computer that controls all the voting machines. And he found 18 voting machine tape results that did not match what the central tabulator had spit out. So there again. And another symptom was, sometimes you'll watch election results come in, and it'll say, like, we have 100 precincts in, and the candidate is at X percent, and then more precincts come in, and suddenly the candidate has less votes. Now, that can't happen. You can't have more precincts come in, and he's got less votes. And this is fairly frequently observed. Well, that can happen when you have fraction magic, because it's capping the percent, and it's saying, look, that person's vote percent is never going to go above this amount, so more votes are coming in. I got to knock some off, you know. And so that is a symptom. So the symptoms are pretty strong that it is being used in various elections. Interestingly, the election we found about 21 of these roundoff errors in one election, and it was all judicial races and criminal justice system races.
Mm.
Interesting, huh?
Very interesting.
It's not, people always think about president, but it's not all about the president. It's about control.
Right, exactly. They're so treacherous. What evil geniuses, huh? I remember. I used to work at a polling place, and we would put all our ballots in a box, and then we'd take them to, the county to count and stuff like that. And when my friend Matt Gonzalez was running for mayor in San Francisco, he narrowly lost to Gavin Newsom, which caused a recount. But during the recount, the couple days after the election, they found several of those boxes floating in the bay. You know, so there's always been ways to tamper with elections, haven't there?
Yes. Yeah. And you know, that's the thing. A lot of people will say, oh, there's a modem in the voting machine. What do you think that means? The truth is, there's 50 ways to do it, or 150, you know, and it doesn't matter what system you use. Just like passing a law against crime doesn't make crime go away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're never going to get a system that is 100% secure from all tampering. What you have to do instead is make it 100% transparent immediately,
right. So
that anybody can see, and you're highly likely to get caught. And, you know, the thing that we were talking about, we saw the photographic images on the web right away, you know, right as they're scanned on election night, and then peg them to the real ballots. It wouldn't matter if you're the Russians or you're a local fixer. You're not going to get by with it if you do that kind of thing. So I think at this stage, we're like, how much are they going to resist a simple method that will give absolute transparency that places have already implemented and has worked, you know? And the people who resist it the most and the locations who resist it the most are basically mapping themselves out as the most likely to be corrupt.
Exactly. Well, Bev Harris, we're out of time. It's been a very interesting conversation for me. So how can my listeners get more involved if they want to be more involved in making sure that our votes are actually counted properly?
You know, some of the best things to do depends which state, because the different states have different situations.
Mm-hmm.
My email is right there on the website, and I have a really big network of folks that I collaborate with in different states. And usually when people email me and want to get involved, then I point them to somebody in their location, because it's kind
Perfect.
Of, it's best address state by state.
Yes.
Because each state literally has a different thing, and tremendous strides have been made. I'm just so impressed with the public and how they have been able to, using their individual creative skills and motivations, get amazing things done.
The heartbeat of America.
BLR 104.1 FM, BerkeleyLiberationRadio.info, on Streama and TuneIn.org. First and third Thursdays at the Long Haul, 3124 Shattuck Avenue, 7:30.
And in the flick